The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from the Week magazine edition dated November 16th. 2012. And as usual, we'll begin with the main story section. The first item is, of course, Obama's ambitious second-term agenda. President Obama was reelected to a second term in office this past week by a sharply divided electorate, his victory secured by a strong turnout of Latino, Black, young, and women voters in swing states. Obama achieved a resounding Electoral College victory with 332 votes to Mitt Romney's 206 by winning narrowly in battleground states like Ohio, Colorado, Virginia, and Florida. He also beat Romney by about 2.5 million in the popular vote. Exit polls showed that the Democrats enjoyed a 6-point lead over Republicans in turnout, with at least 71% of Hispanics voting for Obama, which gave him the margin of victory. White male voters broke for Romney 62-35%, but made up only 34% of the total vote, a 2-point decline from 2008. Returning to the soaring rhetoric of his 2008 campaign, Obama said he'd been humbled and educated by his first term and the election, and he expressed renewed hope for forging consensus on major problems facing the nation. "We are not as divided as our politics suggests," he said. "We are greater than the sum of our individual ambitions, and we remain more than a collection of red states and blue states." On his agenda, he said, were tax and immigration reform, and steps to address climate change. Now here's what the editorials had to say. "Obama fully earned this re-election," said the Los Angeles Times. "His bold actions in 2009 saved the country from a depression, and his health care reform plan will bring coverage to 30 million Americans. Now his second endorsement by the American people gives Obama some political capital, which he must use to forge a compromise on the fiscal cliff of automatic tax hikes and spending cuts coming at the end of this year. After that, he needs to come up with a credible long-term plan for addressing the enormous federal budget deficit, which will require entitlement reform. Solving these problems is a tough order in a partisan age," said the Washington Post, "but Obama's success or failure in doing so will define his presidency. Now the hard work really begins." "Talk about winning ugly," said the Wall Street Journal. "Obama's brutal caricature of Mitt Romney as a plutocrat and intolerant threat to minorities, women, and the poor spurred them to vote Democratic in record numbers, even as he won only about 40% of the white vote. Even then, Obama might have lost had Superstorm Sandy not halted Romney's momentum in the final week. Obama's narrow victory continues his long run of extraordinary good luck. It is no mandate." That is according to the Wall Street Journal. What the columnist said, of course, "Obama has a mandate," said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. "A broad coalition of voters just endorsed the Democratic ideal of activist government. They've already seen the first stages of how Obamacare benefits women, families, and people with pre-existing conditions, and have applauded his intervention to save 1 million jobs in the American auto industry. Democrats have found their Ronald Reagan," said Josh Greenman in the New York Daily News. "In his second term, Obama can become a truly transformational president, both by building on his historic progressive achievements and by providing solid bipartisan economic stewardship. This is a mandate to do what? Said Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal. Obama's agenda is an almost comic mystery. He won the election mainly by frightening women that their free contraception and abortion would be taken away. All this election produced was the same old reality. A Republican House, a Democratic Senate, a president committed to big government hubris, and an overleveraged federal government whose options are steadily narrowing. Obama's economic proposals are actually quite clear, said Jonathan Cohn in TNR.com. He wants responsible spending cuts combined with higher taxes for the wealthy, and in January he's likely to get them. Obama can hold out for a deal as the fiscal cliff nears because the default action, simply letting all the Bush tax cuts expire and mandated defense cuts take effect, is far worse for Republicans than it is for him. Congressional Republicans will try their best to limit his achievements, but as he heads into four more years, Obama is holding some very strong cards. Our next item is the GOP holds House, but Democrats gain in the Senate. Here's what happened on that side of the election. The Democratic Party strengthened its control of the Senate this past week by winning 23 out of 33 contested seats. But Republicans kept their majority in the House of Representatives, ensuring another divided Congress that is likely to hamper President Obama's efforts to enact a legislation. Democrats picked up two seats to gain a 55-45 majority in the Senate, including two independents, disappointing early Republican hopes of retaking the chamber. In Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, a forceful consumer advocate and critic of Wall Street, unseated Republican Senator Scott Brown. Democrat Joe Donnelly won a Senate seat in Indiana after Republican Richard Murdoch said that a pregnancy conceived through rape was something God intended. In Missouri, Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill defeated challenger Todd Akin, whose early poll lead evaporated after he declared that victims of legitimate rape could not get pregnant. In Wisconsin, Representative Tammy Baldwin became the first openly gay senator by defeating former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said his party's strong showing was a sign that Republicans should compromise on a deal over the nation's grave fiscal problems. The strategy of obstruction, gridlock, and delay was soundly rejected by the American people, the Democrat said. Republican House Speaker John Boehner said he would work with any willing partner, Democrat or Republican, to get things done. But he added that by keeping Republicans in control of the House, voters have made it clear that President Obama has no mandate for raising taxes. Now, here's what the editorials had to say. The GOP has only itself to blame for its Senate defeat, said the New York Times. The candidates it picked based on their ideological purity repelled voters once they began speaking their mind. Akin's and Murdoch's extremist abortion positions cost them what should have been easy wins. And former Wisconsin Governor Thompson handed his opponent victory by announcing that he'd do away with Medicaid and Medicare. These radical views used to be found only on the fringes, but have become sadly typical in a Republican Party that has moved too far to the right. Somehow the parties will have to bridge their ideological divide, said the Green Bay, Wisconsin Press-Gazette. More gridlock will spell disaster as the country is due to be hit with some $399 billion in automatic tax increases and $102 billion in spending cuts at the end of the year. Unless Democrats and Republicans can agree on an interim budget, the U.S. will fall off a fiscal cliff and back into recession. It's up to Congress to put aside partisan bickering and do what's in the best interests of the country's economy. Now here's what the columnist said. Compromise is unlikely to emerge anytime soon, said John Judas in TNR.com. Ultra-conservative Tea Party groups that want to purge the Republican Party of any hint of moderation control the GOP. These organizations hate striking deals with the Democrats, and punish Republicans who dare to cross the aisle. In the Indiana primary, for instance, they backed Murdoch over widely respected Senator Richard Lugar, whom they attacked as a traitor for working with Democrats. Republicans won't drive the country into economic ruin just to make an ideological point, said Stephen Stromberg in WashingtonPost.com, but they will use their House majority to advance their priorities in the bargaining to come. The outline of a deal is already there, said Con Carroll in WashingtonExaminer.com. Obama wants to raise taxes on those earning more than $250,000 a year, while Republicans want to prevent defense cuts mandated by the sequester Congress passed in 2011. An agreement on those matters wouldn't immediately address long-term issues like the national debt or entitlement reform, but economic disaster would be avoided and both parties would preserve their top priorities. Democrats should think bigger than that, said David Firestone in NYTimes.com. Their revitalized Senate majority could push Reid to do what he should have done years ago, implement reforms that curb Republican abuse of the filibuster. That would not only give the Senate fortitude on tax and budget issues, but also free up the president to appoint the kinds of judges and Supreme Court justices he wants, without worrying about constant Republican obstruction. After this week's election, that is not an impossible political fantasy. And now we turn to the controversy of the week, the GOP, where do we go from here? What went wrong, said Gerald Seib in the Wall Street Journal. Republicans began the 2012 campaign fully confident that they would wrest back the White House from Barack Obama, but his triumphant reelection this week left them in a cloud of gloom. With unemployment at 7.9% and Americans doubting Obama's economic leadership, Mitt Romney and the GOP should have cruised to an easy victory. Instead, Republicans find themselves caught up in bickering and second-guessing and wondering what it takes to win a presidential election. Romney not only lost, he lost decisively, said Michael Tanner in NationalReview.com. In coming weeks, many will heap the blame on Romney or on Hurricane Sandy or on the liberal media, but if we care about our party, we can't hide behind these facile excuses. The voters just sent us a message, and if Republicans don't do some soul-searching before the next election, this defeat will just be the beginning. If history is any guide, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com, we're going to hear many complain that Romney was insufficiently conservative. But look at what happened this week in the Senate. Hard-right Republican candidates suffered a near wipeout, doubling down on harsh social conservatism and absolutist rhetoric will not be a winning strategy. The American people have had it with GOP extremism, said David Horsey in the Los Angeles Times. As long as Republicans continue to let resentment-filled talk radio blowhards like Rush Limbaugh and religious zealots define the party as anti-science, anti-feminist, anti-gay, and anti-Hispanic, they are doomed to become a party of the past. Demographically speaking, the GOP may already be the party of the past, said Heather McDonald in NationalReview.com. Exit polls on Tuesday showed Obama with a staggering 71 to 27% advantage among Hispanics, the nation's fastest-growing voter bloc. Mitt Romney's hard line on immigration during the primary certainly didn't help, but most Hispanics also much prefer the core democratic principles of a more generous safety net, strong government intervention in the economy, and progressive taxation. That presents Republicans with a real dilemma. Hispanics aren't the only group Republicans have alienated, said Ben Smith in BuzzFeed.com. The electorate is getting younger and more socially liberal, as evidenced by this week's votes to legalize gay marriage in three states. The GOP's future will be determined by how well it adapts to the brand new liberal America, indeed the Obama America, that is now here to stay. As conservatives try to figure out what went wrong, here's another question they need to ask themselves, said Connor Friedsdorf in TheAtlantic.com. Why were we the last to realize that things were going wrong? In the final days of the election, all the polls showed Obama with a commanding lead in the battleground states and the Electoral College. Yet the nation's conservative commentary also almost unanimously predicted an easy Romney victory. For years now, this willful, almost gleeful denial of reality has been the rule, not the exception, inside the conservative echo chamber. In right-wing blogs, radio shows, and Fox News, conservatives convinced themselves that Obama was a Muslim Kenyan socialist who hoped to destroy America, propaganda that the rest of America dismissed as nonsense. Whatever the GOP does to reinvent itself to win elections, those efforts will come to naught unless its conservative base is willing to come to terms with reality. Now, from the controversy of the week, we'll turn to the popular section called A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for doing your civic duty after a Michigan man who was at a polling place filling out his ballot collapsed and apparently died. His heart was restarted by CPR, and when he was revived, his first words were, "Did I vote?" He had. It was a good week for boosting British morale after a new book by author Stuart Laycock, All the Countries We've Ever Invaded and the Few We Never Got Around To, found that Great Britain has invaded 90% of the 200 countries in the world at some point in its history. And it was a good week for planning your vacation to North Korea, after officials there indicated that the 105-story remarkably ugly Rongyang Hotel in Pyongyang might soon open, 23 years behind schedule. They said the hotel would partially, probably, open for business in 2013. It was a bad week for Donald Trump, who reacted to President Obama's re-election by tweeting, "The world is laughing at us," denying he won the popular vote and calling for revolution in this country. It was a bad week for practicing what you preach, after New Orleans Traffic Court Judge Robert Jones III was caught with reflective license plate cover on his car, preventing traffic cameras from photographing his plate. "I was given the car like that," Jones told a reporter. And it was a bad week for vanity after the highly unpopular former mayor of Flint, Michigan, Don Williamson, who resigned in 2009 while facing a recall, installed an 8-foot bronze statue of himself outside his home along with 6 bronze lions. "Someone is going to do something to that statue," neighbor Ryan Duncan speculated. Now back to a little more political news from last week's election. Our first article here is entitled "Victories for Same-Sex Marriage." Voters this past week approved equal marriage rights for same-sex couples for the first time in the nation's history. In Maryland and Maine, ballot initiatives allowing gay couples to marry passed by comfortable margins, and a similar referendum in Washington was expected to pass as final votes were still being tallied last week. Minnesota voters, meanwhile, rejected a measure to amend their state constitution to define marriage as a union between one man and one woman. Gay activists who crafted the winning referenda were careful to include legal provisions that allow religious institutions to refuse to marry same-sex couples, making gay marriage a strictly civil matter. Supporters call last week's decision a historic turning point, since state ballot measures to enable same-sex marriage had been voted down in 32 times in the past. Gay marriage proponents One, because they handle the issue the right way in a democracy, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. They took their case to their fellow citizens and won their support. Add these victories to this week's election of Tammy Baldwin, the first openly gay U.S. senator, and the end of the military's don't ask, don't tell policy, and you have a sea change in attitudes toward gays. Republicans may not like gay marriage, but from now on they fight it at their own risk. The Democrats this week destroyed traditional marriage, said Maggie Gallagher in NationalReview.com. They outspent us 8-1, bringing in the entire Democratic establishment and the big guns of Hollywood. This really is a big loss. No way to spin it. Supporters of gay marriage will have majorities in nearly every state within a decade, said Josh Barrow in Bloomberg.com. Old people with anti-gay attitudes are dying, replaced by accepting young voters. If the Supreme Court does not throw out gay marriage prohibitions as unconstitutional, advocates of gay marriage will have to keep going to the polls, and they will have to get used to winning. Two states legalize marijuana. Colorado and Washington this past week became the first states to legalize the possession and sale of marijuana for recreational use, paving the way for the drug to be regulated like alcohol. In Colorado, Amendment 64, which allows adults over 21 to possess an ounce of marijuana and grow up to 6 marijuana plants, passed with 54% of the vote. In Washington, voters approved Initiative 502, which legalizes possession under the same conditions as in Colorado, but without a grow-your-own provision. Oregon voters defeated a similar ballot measure to legalize recreational pot, while in Massachusetts, voters approved the use of medical marijuana by a wide margin. Voters were right to say yes to legalization, said the Seattle Times in an editorial. Prohibition has failed, and licensing growers will take the drug out of the hands of criminal gangs and into the open where it can be properly regulated. The voters are simply reflecting a growing national trend. According to a 2011 Gallup poll, 50% of Americans now favor legalization of marijuana. They will come to regret it, said Dr. Keith Ablo in FoxNews.com. State officials owe it to their citizens to begin a very aggressive public awareness campaign about the dangers of marijuana use right now. The psychiatric effects of legalizing this insidious gateway drug will be massive. We'll see an increase in depression, attention deficit disorder, memory problems, and accidents at work and on the highways. Marijuana is not harmless. These concerns are probably moot, said Matthew Iglesias in Slate.com. The idea of a legal marijuana industry is intriguing in principle, but before you buy land to start your marijuana farm, please note that Washington and Colorado passed their measures in defiance of federal law. That sets up an inevitable clash with the Obama administration, which has signaled a no-let-up on its enforcement of federal drug laws. As Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper warned, don't break out the Cheetos or goldfish too quickly. And the third and final article on the politics here, at least for this section, no on labeling GM foods. California voters opted not to require labels on foods that contain genetically modified ingredients. That's what the GM stands for, genetically modified. Proposition 37 would have made California the first state in the U.S. to require such labels, already mandatory in Europe, and it might well have led to labeling nationwide. Many U.S. foods are made from corn or other crops containing DNA modified in a lab to resist herbicides, drought, and diseases. The scientific consensus is that GM foods are safe to eat, but activists question that conclusion and argue that consumers have a right to know what they're eating. The labeling requirement led in the polls until last month when the food and chemical industries spent $45 million on a barrage of TV ads against it. The referendum was one of the most heated and emotional on the ballot, said Karen Klein in the Los Angeles Times. Too bad it was so poorly written. allowing companies to simply label everything as possibly containing bioengineered ingredients. The lack of such a label wouldn't have meant that a food was necessarily pure. It might still be laced with pesticides or antibiotics. Yet the labels would have done more than just identify GM, genetically modified food, said Tom Philpott and Mother Jones. They would have started a national conversation on what's wrong with our food supply, how it's so homogenized, uniform, and reliant on a narrow base of seed types owned by a tiny number of giant companies. Proposition 37 was a referendum on corporate domination of the food system. Unfortunately, it was crushed under fat stacks of cash. Big Food scared voters by claiming the labels would cost the average household $400 a year in higher food prices. The No GM campaign also tried to scare consumers with junk science and terms like Frankenfood, said Keith Clure in Slate.com. The activists know that eating genetically modified food is safer than taking a shower. Their real agenda is to dismantle big agribusiness. I, too, prefer to eat organic, but the simple truth is that we inhabit a world of 7 billion people that cannot feed itself with only locally grown grains and vegetables. And now we'll turn to the briefing section from The Week magazine for this week, November 16th, 2012. The briefing article this week is entitled Keeping Out the Sea. Sandy's devastation has awakened urgent interest in protecting populated coasts. Is it really possible? When were the first defenses built against the sea? Well, they go back to the earliest civilizations. People have always been drawn to coastlines. And as human settlements developed, empires invested heavily to keep floods from destroying what they'd built. In the 3rd century BC, Egyptian ruler Ptolemy II had sophisticated dikes built to protect Alexandria's Pharos Lighthouse, one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world. The breakwaters Herod built to protect Caesarea Harbor are still visible in Israel. For centuries, the Japanese have been fashioning bamboo seawalls as protection against typhoons and tsunamis. Today, the challenges are getting tougher. The sea is warming, providing more energy to storms, and it has risen about 7 inches in the last 100 years. As climate change becomes more pronounced and the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets melt faster, ocean levels could increase by 3 to 4 feet by the end of this century, according to computer models. The consequences may be catastrophic as more people move to communities on low-lying coasts. Already, 634 million people, about a tenth of the global population, live close to shorelines, said Gordon McGranahan of the International Institute for the Environment and Development in London. People are running toward risk, he says. Well, what can be done to protect coastal populations? Climate activists say that to stop the inexorable rise of the oceans, we should adopt immediate major restrictions on the burning of fossil fuels. But political resistance to emissions limits is strong in developed and developing countries alike, so there is almost no chance of reaching an agreement on a global reduction of even 20%. And it's probably too late anyway. Due to the amount of carbon dioxide we've already pumped into the atmosphere, even the most draconian measures to slash carbon emissions would not reduce rising tides. Sea level rise cannot be stopped for at least the next several hundred years, climate scientist Gerald Meal concluded in an article published this summer in Nature. Curtailing emissions would only slightly slow what now appears to be inevitable. Can we adapt to higher seas? It can be done, but it's an epic battle requiring ever more heroic means. The city-state of Venice ruled the eastern Mediterranean from a marshy lagoon for centuries, despite frequent tidal flooding from the Adriatic. But in recent decades, ill-considered development, the slow sinking of the islands on which the city is built, and rising sea levels have combined to make Agua Alta, high water, a more regular occurrence. To counter it, construction began in 2003 on a system of 78 giant metal flap gates that will rest flat in the seabed until tides rise to a dangerous level, at which point the gates will be blasted full of compressed air, making them rise up to block the waters. The system called MOSE, Italian for Moses, is due for completion by 2014 and will cost about $6.7 billion. The Dutch, meanwhile, have spent about $6.4 billion in the last half century on the Delta Works, a massive integrated project of sea barriers, sluices, and dams to ward off catastrophic flooding. Yet the Dutch government estimates it will have to spend another $11.4 billion on flood protection measures just to deal with a 10-inch rise in sea levels by 2040. Preparing for a 60-inch rise by 2100 would cost an estimated $59 billion. Are there alternatives to such mega projects? Well, some rural areas prone to flooding have tried managed retreat, relocating development farther than threatened shores. It's also possible to strengthen natural flood protection, such as coastal marshes and other wetlands. Katrina would have wrought less devastation on New Orleans in 2005 if the cypress swamps that once absorbed the impact of storms had not been decimated by decades of development. Large-scale projects to restore such wetlands are underway in the Gulf, the Chinese Bay, and southern San Francisco Bay. But such measures are less workable in highly developed, dense, and low-lying cities like Singapore and New York, where the cost per square foot of land and buildings is among the highest in the world. How can cities be protected? The hot new concept among urban planners is resilience, designing buildings, power lines, and other elements of infrastructure to function even when the next flood arrives. New York City's Environmental Commissioner, Carter H. Strickland, has recommended a series of small interventions, such as more parkland along the East and Hudson Rivers and stiffer flood protection requirements for new developments. But many are convinced that such small-bore solutions won't suffice, and several plans are being shopped around to protect all of New York Harbor with elaborate sea gates and surge barriers that resemble the Delta Works in the Netherlands. Cost estimates of constructing sea gates for New York Harbor range from $10 billion to $30 billion, which until last week seemed totally unrealistic. But with damage estimates from Sandy rising to $50 billion, grand engineering marvels begin to sound more reasonable. It's not prudent to sit here and say it's not going to happen again, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said last week. I believe it is going to happen again. And the footnote to this briefing article, Keeping Out the Sea, is entitled How London Defies the Sea. London, vulnerable to a tidal Thames, much as New York is to the Hudson and East Rivers, acted a generation ago to banish the threat of catastrophic flooding. Construction began in 1974 on the Thames Barrier, about 11 miles downriver from London's city center. When the North Sea surges because of storms pushing floodwaters upriver, the barrier's 10 enormous steel gates rotate and form a barrier. Since its completion in 1982, the barrier has been closed 119 times at increasing frequency, but it has never been breached. Before the tidal defenses were built, there was a contingency plan sounding air raid sirens, moving buses onto higher ground, and tube stations closing, said Steve East of the UK's Environmental Agency. But when the seas now rise, London can go about its normal business without even being aware of the barrier being used. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. as determined by the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled One Nation Bitterly Divided by Charles Lane in the Washington Post. Barack Obama first emerged as a star in 2004 when he called on the nation to unite and declared there's not a liberal America and a conservative America. There's the United States of America. But in this year's presidential campaign, said Charles Lane, a battle-scarred Obama offered not hope of unity, but what he called a choice between two fundamentally different visions for America. Romney, his attack ad said, was not one of us. What went wrong? Simply put, Obama discovered if he had been naive, Americans were deeply divided then, and they are, if anything, more deeply divided now. There are two Americas with conflicting value systems and deep contempt of each other. Even a charismatic president, Obama found, could not transform that dynamic or even resist it. The divide remains, and in coming years, neither party will be able to impose its agenda on deficits, spending, taxes, entitlements, and social issues. The only way to address these problems is through the kind of great compromises forged in our nation's early history, with both liberals and conservatives making painful concessions. The alternative is continued division and paralysis. The next column is entitled The Strange Allure of Disaster Porn by Jack Schaefer in Reuters.com. If you couldn't stop watching the scenes of destruction after Hurricane Sandy, you're not alone, said Jack Schaefer. Disaster porn, some are calling it, cars floating down streets, boardwalks smashed into splinters, massive trees ripped from the ground, subway and car tunnels turned into underground rivers. Why won't we, why can't we, look away? The psychologist's explanation isn't flattering. They say we never feel more alive than in times of distress, danger, and calamity. We feel a cathartic rush, a media buzz, in other words, from observing the suffering of others at a safe distance. Oh, the horror! Pass the popcorn. By watching together and creating a collective narrative, we also insulate ourselves from the trauma of these images. That's why we couldn't stop watching the World Trade Center towers burn and fall. Each new viewing helped us integrate the shock of seeing skyscrapers full of people collapsing. If you've found it difficult to stop watching coverage of the Hurricane Sandy disaster, as I have, don't be too ashamed. The only thing worse than looking too much is not looking at all. And the next column is called Better Living Through Biotechnology, written by David Ewing Duncan in the New York Times. How far would you go to modify yourself using the latest medical technology? Asked David Ewing Duncan. Within the next 20 to 30 years, scientists will create a revolution in bioenchantment, from drugs that boost your memory to brain implants that enable you to drive your car using only your mind, to artificial legs that are far faster and stronger than real ones. But the coming age of enhancement will present troubling ethical questions. When parents are asked if they would give their child a brain-boosting pill guaranteeing straight A's, most say no. But if you tell them that all the other kids in their child's class will be taking the pill, almost all say yes. Clearly, these kinds of bio-improvements will quickly become not just desirable, but irresistible. And what then? We might see the wealthy with a permanent physical, genetic, or bionic advantage, say superhuman eyesight or incredible strength. Surgeons, pilots, even presidents might be expected to get neural implants to optimize their job performance. As bionic enhancements become a reality, they will challenge our assumptions about what it means to be human. Now we'll flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week for the last word. Our article this week is entitled The Player. For Barack Obama, says David Moranis, the path to victory has been marked by fierce drive and a little luck. Barack Obama was at his red brick home on Chicago's South Side when the good news started reaching him early in the night. He was in the fold of his family when New Hampshire became the first swing state to fall his way, and when the incomplete but encouraging results from Florida made it seem more likely that the title of president would precede his name for another 4 years. He was watching television and working the phones at the Fairmont Hotel when Wisconsin went for him, and then Iowa. Soon enough, NBC became the first network to declare him the winner, and then other networks and major newspapers followed by giving him Ohio, and with it, the election. It was 10:19 p.m. here when the president learned for certain that he would not be fired and could instead think about getting fired up and ready to go again. Kisses, handshakes, fist bumps in the hotel room. Nearby at McCormick Place, where a vast throng awaited him, the dancing began. Ear-splitting, joyous shouting erupted and would not stop as more blue states piled up the Electoral College margin. So much for a long and tense election night. The lingering question was when Mitt Romney would place a call of congratulations, a gesture that did not come until near midnight on the East Coast, as the GOP team in Boston hoped against hope for a miracle that would not come. Only after the call finally arrived and Romney delivered a gracious concession speech did the president and his entourage start to make their way to the victory celebration. President Obama stepped on the stage at 12:36 a.m. Chicago time. Overwhelmed by cheers, his victory after a brutally expensive and hard slog of a campaign continued his history-making story. Now he was not just the first African-American president, but the first African-American president to win re-election, and the third president in succession to be elected to two terms, the first such run since the Founding Fathers' trio of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. In the era when blacks were enslaved and not allowed to vote, the night's convincing early end marked the final act of a campaign-closing 36-hour drama for No Drama Obama, a passion play tinged with nostalgia, framed by fierce competitiveness, and touched, as always with him, by a bit of luck. Tuesday began with the president crashing to sleep in his old bedroom on the South Side and awakening to the bright chill of a day that would decide his political fate. Up and at it early for a phone interview with a popular black radio program and a conference call on Hurricane Sandy relief efforts, the president was out the door and inside the back of his limousine by 8:53 a.m., dressed for success in dark suit, white shirt, and silver and black striped tie, as his motorcade wended through the familiar streets of his adopted hometown. In the final hours before the election was decided, as the weather turned dank and drizzly, he stopped by a field office to call volunteers in neighboring Wisconsin, cranked up the vote again with a series of satellite television interviews from the Fairmont Hotel, gunned his left-handed barely jumping jump shot in a ritual good luck game of pickup hoops with old pals and a few pros at an athletic club, and picked up the state-by-state scoop from hardwired political aides. Mostly decent weather in key battleground states, mildly encouraging exit polls. Sandy apparently more determinative than the first debate. Heavy turnout, long lines in key precincts. Another round of swing state TV interviews occupied him in the late afternoon. Then in the darkness, he rode home to Kenwood on the rim of Hyde Park to eat dinner and chat with family and friends and to wait. POTUS was loose, observed Jay Carney, his press secretary, using the now common acronym for President of the United States. Loose but anxious as he waited to see whether he and his wife and daughters would keep living in the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington or be sent home to the big red brick house on Greenwood Avenue in Chicago. Even nostalgia seems to flash instantaneously in this age of tweets and posts. At the end, as the 51-year-old president and his associates close their forward motto campaign journey with one last musical tour of Midwestern swing state capitals and made the pilgrimage back to base camp, they at times appeared overtaken by a remembrance of things past. It was only 16 years ago that Barack Obama began his remarkable political rise in the Illinois State Senate. 8 years ago that the nation first got to know him with his keynote address at the Democratic National Convention in Boston, and 5 years ago that he started running for president. And now this part of his life, the running for office part, was essentially done and gone. 5 years, a blip in time, yet now so long ago. He ended his last campaign where he began his first presidential run in Iowa, at a late-night rally staged in Des Moines at the intersection of 4th and Locust, across the street from his first campaign office, where he recalled the heat didn't work for a week, and his young troops had to wear hats and gloves inside. The waves of nostalgia that enveloped Obama and his team at campaign's end evoked more than the passage of time. There was also a longing for the magic of 2008, when everything seemed fresh and freighted with promise. Some veterans of that campaign came back to share the moment. Some wore 08 fleeces, like pro football players taking the field in throwback jerseys. Stubble beards sprouted in Back to the Future fashion. The president himself invoked the Yes We Can chants for one more reprieve. It was also bonhomie and reminiscent at once, heartfelt, and a shield from the possibility of difficult news to come. Bruce Springsteen, who traveled on Air Force One with the president all day Monday and sang at his final stops in Madison, Columbus, and Des Moines, put this sensibility in his own lyrical terms when he described the emotions that had washed over him on election night 4 years ago. It was an unbelievable evening when the longings of your heart felt fulfilled, recalled the boss. But that was then, he added, and the lesson Obama supporters had learned was that change was not a tide rushing in, but a slow movement, inch by inch, day by day. Obama's own wistfulness, he teared up at his last event, was accompanied at the end by his acknowledgement of all the difficult moments that followed that night in Grant Park when he first strode onto the world stage as president-elect. The gray hairs on my head, he said, were testament to what he had endured. He took to using the devastation of last week's storm as a metaphor for the obstacles the nation faced during his first term. No matter how hard the storm is, he said, the country recovered together. One of the questions that only election results would answer was whether Hurricane Sandy, for all its tragic consequences, had nonetheless arrived as a sort of due ex machina during the final act of the 2012 campaign play, slowing Mitt Romney's momentum and providing another example of Obama's luck. Luck means something in politics only when a candidate knows how to take advantage of it, and Obama has used luck to his benefit consistently throughout his career. He was lucky when a state Senate seat opened up unexpectedly in 1996. Lucky when he became part of that body's majority through a redistricting that was determined by a name drawn from a hat after a partisan deadlock. Lucky when Democratic nominee John Kerry chose him to deliver the convention keynote speech in 2004. And lucky again when one possibly tough opponent after another either did not run or dropped out during his successful bid that year for the U.S. Senate. Sandy was of a different magnitude altogether in every respect, yet it appeared to fit the pattern. That Obama believes in luck, or at least holds to the superstitions of the typical jock, was evident in his determination to play Basketball Tuesday, as he did so many times during the 2008 primaries, to while away an hour or two as he awaited election results. The players he brought in for this final campaign game wove together many threads of his life, including, among others, Mike Ramos, a pal from his teenage years on the varsity team at Punahou College or Punahou School in Honolulu, Craig Robinson, his brother-in-law and one of Princeton's all-time scorers, Marty Nesbitt, his closest friend from Chicago, Arnie Duncan, Secretary of Education, a Chicagoan who played varsity ball at Harvard, Reggie Love, the former Duke player who served as his body man in the White House for the first 3 years, and the big ringer, Scottie Pippen, a star from the championship years of his beloved Chicago Bulls. The president managed to have Pippen on his team. The lanky lefty captain sank a few shots, according to others, and Pippen sank many more. They won by some 20 points. For all his apparent ambivalence about some aspects of the game of politics, a characteristic that worked to his detriment during the first presidential debate, Obama always maintained a fierce will to prevail, whether in basketball or elections. The night ended with one last win in his last campaign. And that article was copyrighted 2012 by the Washington Post Company. Now we'll turn to the health and science section from the Week magazine for this week. Our first article here is entitled, How Your Childhood Shapes Your Politics. Your decision to vote for President Obama or Mitt Romney this week may have originated in your childhood. That's the implication of a long-term study into the voting behavior of 700 people whose parents were interviewed about how they were raised and how they acted as children. Researchers found that regardless of race, economic status, intelligence, or gender, kids whose parents believed that children should always obey their parents were more likely to vote conservative when they reached voting age, while those whose parents believed that children should be allowed to disagree with their parents were more likely to become liberals. The study also found that people whose parents described them as having been fearful and cautious at ages 4 and 5 leaned Republican as young adults. Those who were active and restless as young children tended to prefer Democratic policies later on. Scientists aren't sure how our childhood temperaments and experiences lead us to develop specific ideological positions, University of Illinois psychologist Chris Fraley tells the Toronto Star. But it's clear, he says, that how we behaved and were disciplined as kindergartners at least partly determines our views on political issues like abortion, military spending, and the death penalty. And I have to tell you that there is a picture here of Rush Limbaugh, and it says maybe his parents are to blame. So I wanted to pass that along to you as well. Now let's take a look at the health scare of the week. This week it is complications of pregnancy. The number of women in the U.S. suffering severe complications during and after childbirth has increased dramatically in the past decade, a new study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finds. Researchers analyzed the rate of pregnancy-related complications, including heart attack, stroke, and kidney failure, between 1998 and 2009, and found that incidents during delivery rose 75%. While post-delivery incidents more than doubled. Experts aren't sure why, but it may be because the characteristics of the pregnant population are changing to include more of both older and obese women, as well as women with potentially dangerous health conditions like high blood pressure and diabetes, study author William Callahan tells Reuters.com. More young women with health problems that can lead to high-risk pregnancies, such as congenital heart defects, are also having children. Heart problems were the most common fatal complication, causing the rate of emergency cardiac surgery needed during or after delivery to rise dramatically over the past decade. Callahan says not all complications can be avoided, but the best outcomes happen when a woman is as healthy as possible going into pregnancy. And now another short article from the Health and Science section, How Cooking Made Us Smart. Why did the brains of our human ancestors experience a growth spurt some 1.8 million years ago, granting us intelligence that's superior to that of other primates? Credit the invention of cooking, Brazilian neuroscientist Susana Herculano-Huzel tells The Guardian. She and her colleagues found that heating food, which speeds up chewing and digestion and allows the body to absorb more nutrition per bite, enabled Homo erectus to ingest the calories needed to feed the human brain. Our brain makes up 2% of our body mass, or 5 times the proportion of a gorilla's brain, and consumes 20% of our total energy intake, more than twice the percentage of gorilla's brain requires. After examining the caloric requirements of a host of primate species, the researchers determined that had our Homo erectus ancestors stuck to raw food diet, they would have had to spend more than 9 hours per day just ingesting food in order to fuel their larger brains. Cooking, Herculano-Huzel says, is the most obvious answer to the question, what can humans do that no other species does? And now, as we reach the end of the program, a couple of short items. This was the most negative presidential campaign in modern history. A full 86% of President Obama's television ads and 79% of Mitt Romney's were negative. By comparison, Obama and John McCain spent an average of 69% of their TV budgets on negative ads in 2008, and George W. Bush and John Kerry spent 58% in 2004. China is facing an exodus of its richest citizens to Australia, Canada, and the U.S. A recent survey found that 16% of Chinese citizens worth more than $1.6 million have obtained foreign residency, and an additional 44% are planning to immigrate. They cited pollution, endemic corruption, and poor medical care among their reasons for wanting out. And President Obama has been very stingy in dispensing presidential pardons, pardoning just 22 individuals while denying 1,019. He has granted pardons to roughly one of every 50 applications. At this point in their presidencies, Ronald Reagan had pardoned one of every 3 applicants. George H.W. Bush had pardoned 1 in 16. Bill Clinton had pardoned 1 in 8. And George W. Bush had pardoned 1 in 33. And the poll watch for this week, 67% of Americans approve of how President Obama is handling Hurricane Sandy recovery efforts, 16% disapprove. And 51% of Americans now believe that climate change causes more frequent natural disasters, while 23% say it doesn't. 32% say Hurricane Sandy was connected to climate change, while 34% say that it wasn't. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next week.